to be an excellent database for our website. Any questions?
Yes, I have a question. Why didn't you use MongoDB? MongoDB is a web-scale database and doesn't use SQL or joins, so it's high performance.
That's an excellent question. We evaluated several NoSQL databases and concluded that the options are still too immature for our production needs. MySQL is a proven database that is used across the web and it has the features we need.
But it doesn't scale. Everybody knows that relational databases don't scale because they use joins and write to disk.
Scalability is a complicated topic and it's hard to make a general statement like that.
Relational databases weren't built for web scale. MongoDB handles web scale. You turn it on and it scales right up.
It may surprise you that there are a handful of high-profile websites still using relational databases and in particular MySQL.
Relational databases have impedance mismatch.
I think you mean impedance.
MySQL is slow as a dog. MongoDB will run circles around MySQL because MongoDB is web scale.
MongoDB does have some impressive benchmarks, but they do some interesting things to get those numbers. For example, when you write to MongoDB, you don't actually write anything. You stage your data to be written at a later time. If there's a problem writing your data, you're fucked. Does that sound like a good design to you?
If that's what they need to do to get those kick-ass benchmarks, then it's a great design.
If you are stupid enough to totally ignore durability just to get benchmarks, I suggest you pipe your data to DevNull. It will be very fast.
If DevNull is fast and web scale, I will use it. Is it web scale?
You are kidding me, right? I was making a joke. I mean, if you're happy writing to a database that doesn't give you any idea that your data is actually written, just because you want high performance numbers, why not write to DevNull? It's fast as hell.
Does DevNull support sharding?
Holy shit. For my own mental health, I'm going to assume you're just messing with me and aren't actually retarded. Do you even know what a shard is?
Shards are the secret ingredient in the web scale sauce. They just work.
Please tell me you don't actually make a living in a technology field.
I'm a web programmer.
As of this moment, I officially resigned from my job as software engineer and will take up work on a farm shoveling pig shit and administering anal suppositories to sick horses because that will be 1,000 times more tolerable than being in the same industry as dipshits like you. You read the latest post on highscalability.com and think you're a fucking Google architect and parrot slogans like web scale and sharding, but you have no idea what the fuck you are talking about. You're going to blow some project to hell because you get a Woody playing with software like it's a sex doll. Relational databases have been around since the fucking 70s and are some of the most mature technology you can find. Yet somehow everything needs to be reinvented because Google and Amazon post some white papers. If you need to build a globally distributed search engine that manages petabytes of data, fine, build your own database. But if you're like 99.9% of companies, you can probably get by very well with something like MySQL and maybe Memcache.
Redis will kick Memcache's ass. It's so fast and scalable.
Right now I'm thinking of how much fun it will be to castrate my first bull, down on the farm. I cannot wait to cut off the testicles of a 3,000-pound raging bull as it tries to kick my head in.
MongoDB is a document database that doesn't need joins. It uses MapReduce.
Now I'm cleaning a cistern of chicken shit, but I don't care because I don't have to listen to the NoSQL fanboys reciting the feature list of their favorite schema-free database.
So it's probably hard to top that. If you want to listen to their last, even more obnoxious 6 minutes, this is the link. Good morning. My name is Gert Drapers. I'm a program manager in the SQL Server development team. And the reason why I played this video is actually exactly why you're here. All right. How many of you are NoSQL developers? Nobody dares to raise their hand now. No offense. So, how many of you are SQL guys? Wow, awesome. Okay, well, thanks for joining me. So, over the last 2 years, I've been spending my time inside the SQL Server development team working on building up a NoSQL strategy. And the key thing there was is like that I found myself spending most of my time explaining what we call Building 35, which is the building where SQL Server is. It's like everybody in Building 35, what NoSQL is and what it's not. And then I moved to another team. I moved into the directory team, and I started working on this scale-out directory that needed to go into Azure. Some of you might know the Active Directory, what is in there, right? Users, groups, memberships, manager relationships. And we started doing this, as we'll see at the end of the presentation, by using a relational schema. We thought while we're re-architecting the Active Directory, why build something else than a relational, or use something else than a relational database? And we run into some interesting learnings, which are actually directly related to a lot of things that the NoSQL community is trying to solve. So what we're going to do today is actually talk about is like NoSQL and take you on the journey that I took my team on when we actually moved from one implementation to the other, trying to figure out where we needed to go. So you don't have to repeat the same mistakes that we made. All right, so now, actually, so I've done this presentation a couple of times. It's actually a lot more fun if we have a little interaction. All right, so don't shy away. That makes it more interesting because most of the times, the guy or person sitting next to you or girl next to you has the same ideas, opinions, or wants to yell it out too, so here you go. So NoSQL. All right, first of all, it's like, that sounds offensive to most of you here because the majority of you guys raise their hands and says, like, we're actually SQL developers. And this NoSQL thing actually is offending, right? It's like, NoSQL, what does that mean? It's like, you don't want us to be using SQL? Is SQL a dead language? Is there something wrong with the language? Well, actually, if you start digging into this, the intent was, if you start listening really to the NoSQL community and what they're trying to do, is they will turn this into not only SQL, and it's mainly about the fact that it's like we're recognizing that a relational database is not a Swiss Army knife. And there are problems in the industry that do require a different approach and different storage solutions. All right, and we can try to put a square peg into a round hole, as we say. All right, but it doesn't work efficiently. You might make it fit, but at the end of the day, it's not as seamless as it should be. All right, so now over the last couple of years, there is a vast explosion of all sorts of of NoSQL storage vendors or products that are popping up. All right. Very fancy name or interesting names like MongoDB, CouchDB, which must be very pleasant to work with that one, right? It's like you can sit on the couch all day. So Neo is like RavenDB, the Tokyo cabinets, like all examples of NoSQL stores that have popped up over the last years. For those of you who joined me in my session about big data, HBase is an implementation, a key value store implementation that actually resides on top of Hadoop, right? So it resides on top of the HDFS file system. Most of these other ones actually have implementations that are independent of those kind of structures and can be hosted on a variety of platforms. So what we're going to do is I'm not going to pick one because it's like that's not the goal of this exercise. The goal of the exercise is to figure out is like why are people going down this route? What is so attractive? And what should we as SQL Server people learn about this? And maybe that informs us about what we should do next. So let's first start with what are the kinds of interesting parts that you find in the various NoSQL data stores. So first of all, there are a variety of consistency models that you see across those, right? Inside SQL Server, or if you go to Oracle or IBM DB2, it's like the first rule that we have, right? And this is definitely true in the SQL Server team. So in the SQL Server team, this might be an interesting thing to actually reveal to you guys. So we have a bunch of priorities that we give the development team, the engine developers, that is. Rule number one, you will never lose any data. Right? SQL Server is like a bank. Well, that might be a wrong thing these days. Gold, maybe. Okay. But it's supposed to be safe. Right? No matter what you do, your data is supposed to be safe. So that's the first principle that we tell the development team. You always have to make sure that we never corrupt or lose any data. That's just futile for your reputation as a database vendor. All right. Maybe the banks can learn something from us. So rule number two. Anybody wants to guess what rule number two is? Yeah, close. Consistency. Provide the right answer. Right? If you ask a query and you ask it again and again and again, what is the application or the user expect that he gets the same answer? Right? So we have to be, and you can call that consistency or referential integrity. It's like these are all things that come into play. But it's like that's rule number two. Then we'll think about performance. And a lot of people that come into the team, they actually are like, hey, we can do things a lot faster. Well, hold on. What are we going to do with consistency? So the first thing that they have to read when they join our team is the Transaction Bible. Jim Gray's book about transactional processing. Right, it's a big book. I forgot what the publisher is. But it's like it's mandatory reading for every engine developer inside our team. And it starts with consistency rules. What are the ACID properties? How do we guarantee atomicity? How do we deal with isolation levels so we have multiple concurrencies? It's like, what is the behavior if you're in this isolation mode and you execute the query multiple times? All things that you guys have learned while you were working with SQL, either the hard way or some other way. All right. Because it's like, there are interesting behaviors, right? Some of you have the pleasure to work with things like COM transactional objects, for example, right, which has the nice side effect that it likes it defaults your transactional isolation to serializable. And then it's like they're wondering, it's like, why is it so slow? Well, it's trying to serialize everything. Any guess why we did that? So this goes back all the way to MTS, right? Microsoft Transaction Server. When we were building the app server and we were promoting Visual Basic 6, I believe, as the programming model, And so what did we learn is like, well, if we have those VB programmers hack against the database, they don't know jack doodle about transactions. So we better be safe than sorry. So what do? Well, we give them the safest isolation level, which is serializable. All right, that way, the demo that MTS shipped with, which was a debit credit demo, right, worked, and it worked well, and it was reliable, but it wasn't performing. Now, what do we see with a lot of the NoSQL stores is that they're actually explicitly trading off and making decisions about consistency. Some of them don't try to even be consistent. They're very casual about this. Some of them say it's like, we'll pick up the deltas down the road, and we'll eventually get into a consistent state. Now, I've worked on Active Directory, and if you deployed Active Directory in your organization and you have multiple domains, you know that it's like we have multi-master application. Right? That means that we can make changes on multiple places. What happens if you make a change to your account on one domain controller and then on the other? Well, you can be lucky. Right? You change property A, I change property B, and we'll happily live together. What if we both changed our title? Last rider wins. Right? At the end of the day, it's a very simplistic merge algorithm which Active Directory uses. Now, SQL Server doesn't allow these kind of things, and it's very strict. And it's so strict that it's like, you cannot turn it off. How many of you had, especially for those of you who are trainers or consultants, how many of you time had the question, can I turn off the transaction log? Right. I get it all the time. Right? And then you go back and it's like, well, let me explain what we're trying to do, what the purpose of a relational database in this case is. And if you want, if you don't like that level of consistency, maybe this relational database is not for you. Right? And what we're seeing here is that we might have a case. The second part is about schema. So in the traditional world, it's like we spend a lot of time, hopefully, defining our schema for our relational database. We're very intentional about tables and keys and the size of a key. True, right? It's like we're intentional about the size of keys. We know cluster keys, primary keys. We never use GUIDs as primary keys for a cluster key, right? No. Now, Microsoft SIP software would actually let you do this, so it's like we're guilty too. All right, but it's like we are normally trying to be very intentional. And we have to do that up front, and we have to model it, and then we modeled it, and then we start building applications or reports or everything that starts to consume the data. So we're living in a model-first world, because realistically, without a model, without a schema, SQL Server is just a dumb bit bucket. It's worthless. And you're laughing about this. It's like, I actually had these same people in building 35. I had to explain them. My team is doing the last mile, right? It's like we're from the app tier to the programmer. That's what my team does. And I had to explain. So I had people come to me. It's like, why does your team exist, man? It's like, if my team does not exist, you don't make any money. All right? You need apps on top of SQL Server to use it. Otherwise, it's like it's just there wasting energy. Now, the NoSQL guys take a different approach. They want to go from, I'm a developer. I know what I need. I have a data structure here. I just want to take that data structure and persist it. Why should that be so hard? Why should I think that it's like about the fact that it's like if I have a data structure here and a table there, that these need to be in sync somehow, or I need to have an object relational mapping technology that allows me to take a class, a structure, and serialize it into a table. All right, what are these ORMs? If you dumb it down to a degree, it's like I had to do a television interview the day before yesterday, and they told me it's like I needed to bring it down to a Sesame Street level. All right, so this is Sesame Street level of that. So now we also see that there are the stores that really don't care about the schema. They don't enforce it. They leave it up to the application. They're just a bit bucket with some structural behind it. And so we see different options. Schema-less, no schema, partial schemas, no enforcement, server-side enforcement, application-level enforcement, etc. The next thing where we see difference is within the programming models. How do developers interact with the database? And so the NoSQL stores, they come from a different world. All right? It's like database engine developers are a special breed of people, apparently. It's like they think about, it's like I have one person in the engine. I worked with him in 1996 when I was in the storage engine, and he's still there, and he still loves it. He just loves internal data structures and storage and all these things. And they're a special kind of people. Most people don't stay that long, actually. But it's like if you go from the other side, if you're the user, right, how do you want to interact with your database? Well, again, it's like you want to take that structure that you have. But how do you want to communicate with the server? Well, a lot of these people these days trying to solve problems that go over HTTP boundaries, right, that have flaky connections, that are guaranteed to fail, that need to have a wide reach of devices, not just a PC. Now they need to reach to a tablet, right, to an iPad, an Android phone, and all sorts of other things that they need to be able to connect to. So they want to be device agnostic. That requires them to write loosely coupled code. Wow. That dismisses the whole object relational mapping technologies, because there is nothing loosely coupled in that, right? Because that creates very tight coupling between your tables and your classes. And God forbid if you make a change in your table now, because most object relational mapping technologies are not that forgiving at that point. Right? So they come at the problem from a completely different angle. So if you take that, it's like then they are going to develop very different storage fabrics or storage solutions to their problems. And there actually is some hierarchy in this. It's like most of them actually started from a key value store approach. Right? If you look at Memcache, right, Memcached, for the longest time was known as a cache front end that you put in front of your database or in front of your middle tier server to do app tier caching. Right? Because it was blazingly fast in looking up a blob based on a single key, and so that's what you used it for. A lot of technologies actually derive their implementation from that starting point. Most NoSQL stores can actually be rooted back to that technology. Some of them actually flipped it around and said, it's like, hey, instead of having this row-oriented view, we're trying to do warehousing things, and so we take a dimensional view over a column. And so we're actually going to construct a column store. One of the things that you see now is like in SQL Server 2012, that we're adding column indexes, right, on into the relational store to actually do exactly that. Right? We see document stores where people actually take their structure and persist it. So the developer now is dealing with a serialization, deserialization problem more than anything. And he retrieves the document based on a key. So at the end, it's still a key value store, but the value is more structured and more complex. All right. A graph store is most of the time a combination of a document store plus special indexing to represent what they first started with, social network graphs. Now what we'll see at the end is what the conclusion that we came on to the, from the directory team is how we could actually leverage its like graph store and document store technologies to solve, for example, a directory-like problem. The other part is like they take a completely different approach about scale. And we talked about this yesterday, right, when we discussed Hadoop and why are people so interested in Hadoop. And I talked about the pizza box approach, and then afterwards somebody came to me and says, what is a pizza box? Besides that you can eat it, right? It's basically that blade system that you just stick a whole bunch of blades in your rack and you keep stacking up and you keep adding them to your world. And there is this desire to actually use this common technology to scale out instead of scaling up. Because what is the downside of scaling up? Well, yes, right? It's definitely expensive. Right? Your hardware vendor will love you. Sorry? It's not cloud ready. Wow, you're in a marketing team? So, I agree, right? Or maybe the answer would be the cloud is not ready to actually consume that workload, right? That's a different way of thinking about it. It's definitely true that scale-up has its limits. Scale-up is like the Dutch traffic system of highways. Right? You create 5 lanes between Amsterdam and Utrecht, and then you go back to 2. That's scale-up, right? You're moving bottlenecks from one place to the other constantly. A perfect scaling system is where things are in balance. Right, where your CPU utilization, your bus utilization, your disk I.O. is like network, it's like your SAN cards, it's like they're all in balance. Right? There is a good ratio of your SAN controllers to the number of processors relationship to the bus speeds. How many of you think when you buy hardware what the speed of your bus is? You should. Right, because like your machine comes with various speeds. I've been bitten by that more than once. You put your card into one slot, and it's like you wonder why the performance is so bad. And then you start reading the spec, and it says, this is a 66 megahertz slot, and that's a 133 megahertz slot. That's twice the size difference. If you happen to put your SAN card in that 66 megahertz slot, you're losing out. Right? And I've learned that the hard way. So, at the end, then, it's like it's about persistence. How do we persist? What do we persist it on? Are we persisting on some common technology, just SATA drives that we're replicating it around? One thing that they don't want to do is spend gazillions of money on these expensive SANs. They just want to stack up a bunch of disks that they go buy, and if it dies, you just throw it away and put in a new one. And hopefully the system repairs itself. That's the goal. So, okay, so now we looked at the traits of those NoSQL systems. Now, so what is this really about? And you can ask everybody in this room and we'll get all different answers. All right. I think there are 3 key things that people see as indicators why people are reaching out to a new technology. It's about application availability, scalability, and the drive to be agile. Right. People want to and have a need to move faster. And we've tried that and we've come to sort of similar conclusions. We see that the paradigm of processing is shifting. Right, yesterday we talked about MapReduce. Another one is sharding, where it's like you're basically taking your data set and partitioning it out. For most workloads, it's okay to have less stringent consistency requirements. But you have to be well aware of what you're doing here. All right. You also need to think about is like what the data model is that you're going to use. Are you going to define your schema first? Is it going to be an open schema? Are you going to work on documents? Is there a graph relationship between key value stores? Do we have a rich document format? That's what RDF stands for. So at the end of the day, it's like, it's about how we operate on the data store, how we develop against the store, and how agile can the application be. Now, most of those stores actually add the sharding pattern to their set of capabilities. Now, sharding on itself, it ain't rocket science. Right? We've done this. Like I've built literally at least 5 customer implementations manually. And all it is, it's like it's making sure you partition your data and you have a good routing system. That's what it starts with. Sounds simple, right? Wait till you implement it. Right. Because what you want to achieve is linear scaling. Maybe not at the same curve as you would get with scale up, but at least for a much lower price point. Right. They also want to be able to have the application be partitionable. Now, what is a key restriction for your application to be shardable? Anybody? What is a must-have? If you say, it's like, if your boss comes to you and says, we're going to shard our application, you instantly think and say, we don't have a shard key. What is the universal key that we're going to use to divide our world over this problem? I'll go back to my example of my Active Directory experience. So in the Active Directory, we basically only have 2 entities at a very rudimentary form, back to Sesame Street levels. Right, we have users and we have groups. And groups can contain users and can contain other groups. So what is my shard key? If my users and my groups don't fit on a single node anymore, how am I going to split them out? I can't, because I have an open closure problem. Right? My relationships go across nodes. So now I'm facing the problem that how do I know if something is local versus something is remote? Right, now I have the NUMA problem. Some of my memory is local to the processor, some of it I have to go to the other memory bank that is with the other nodes. Right. And you need to build that logic now in your app server. So if you have a tight closure problem, you can use sharding. Because now you have a shard key that makes it very easy for that app router, for all your workloads, to figure out where it needs to go. This is why scale up is not dead, because we simply have problems on our hands, which we cannot break apart yet. So from an operational point of view, you want to worry about the availability of your service. So as I said, when we were bringing the directory team up into the cloud, our first attempt was to build a relational model, nice, expensive relational model, lots of entities, relationships, foreign keys, very nice. But we also needed to be available because we're a service. Right. My oldest brother was getting married again last week, and so I was trying to order a present at the Bayekorov. So I'm going online. Of course, I'm 9 hours later. What do you get? Sorry, the store is closed. The worldwide internet. Right, your service needs to be available. You cannot simply take it down. You're losing out on things. Even simple things like maintenance operations, you have to plan. You cannot take your server down. Now, there are some interesting constraints that we will see in the next slide. How we're going to trade off these things. Because there are three dimensions, as described in the CAP theorem by Eric Brechner. Right. We have availability as a dimension, consistency, and partition tolerance. And you cannot have all three of them, although there is now research being done that claims that you can have all three in very ideal situations. We haven't seen any practical implementations, actually, that allow us to do this. So, until proven wrong, we need to figure out, like, where do we give up? Right? And putting this simple theorem up, I use this a lot when discussing architectural designs with customer teams or other people, just to make them realize it's like you cannot have the world. Right? They come in and it's like it needs to be highly available, it needs to be performance, it's like it needs to be full consistency model. Like, you have to give somewhere. Right? And you need to create this hybrid environment that you need to go. Right? So you need to figure out, like, is it okay to lose data? What is the consistency between nodes? What is the in case of availability, what happens? So from an operational point of view, we need to worry about our performance and our scale. Right? How do we automate our lifecycle management? How do we deploy this? Why is that important? How many of you operate a live service? A handful, right? What is the most futile thing that you can do to your database? Okay, crash. You win. Okay, didn't think about that one, I'm sorry. But I should have. Assume failure at all times. Change the schema. Why? It takes an exclusive lock on your table. Everything else blocks. You create one big traffic jam in your system until your schema operation is done. So now you're an application writer, and you ask to actually build in extensibility. What are people going to do? Oh, I want this new property. What is that going to mean? Oh, well, I'm going to add column to table. Well, that doesn't work. So back to the drawing board. And very quickly, you will end up with an attribute value schema, which we know performs really poorly. Why? Our data distribution inside attribute value tables is very poor. Or you're going to have a proliferation of tables, then your data distribution in the tables is great, but now you're joining the hell out of the world. And then you are going to have another problem. So none of these two approaches are really working. How many of you use front-end identity manager? Then I won't spill the beans, okay? Nobody. The reason why I asked the question is, like, 3 years ago is like I got the assignments, like, can you look at this? And I open up the code. I'm like, is that the schema? Really? One table. It was called objects. It had an object ID, which was a GUID. It had a string column, an integer column, a datetime column, and a Boolean column. And a GUID column. So they could reference themselves. This was one big inner join party, self-referencing to the max. Of course, this doesn't work. But this is not the only case. Right? We caught this before it got into the wild. But there are many cases where we've run into situations where people are trying to do things like this to circumvent the problem. And I understand how they get there. Right? It's not that I don't understand, it's like how people get to the conclusion of this might seem like a good idea. But then it's like if you start using a real data set to test it, you might figure out that you have bigger problems. And then forget about that index on the Boolean column. So the key thing that the developer actually is looking for is he wants to write his structures first. He knows what to do. He has a persistence problem. And this is the impedance mismatch between who comes first. Right? In most organizations these days, it's like it's the developer who starts first, comes with something, and then it's like he runs into a DBA or a database person that says like, well, maybe this is not a good idea. I don't want to listen to you. I have to be done next week. Sounds familiar? So the developer then thinks, is like, dude, these guys, they're a burden. I don't want to work with them. I need to have my own model. So they literally want to lower the pain of adoption of their application, and they want flexibility. They want to be able to move around. They want to move fast. It's like, if we change this and change that, they want to be happy. So the last category is like in terms of application agility, right? We need to have this model work in services, but also agnostic to a lot of devices that now consume this data. It needs to be elastic with regards to demands in terms of like how many requests a second, which is why a lot of people actually opt for sharding. Why? Because that app tier is a data router and stateless. And we know that everything that is stateless, we can just replicate a stateless machine and move it around. What is the problem with a relational database? It's far from stateless. Which is why it's like we have to be very careful. And then the other part is that we're more and more getting to the fact that we're composing applications out of other applications more and more. So that's what we need to do. So this is what the NoSQL guys all want to achieve. Now let's take a moment and reflect back how we see this from a SQL Server point of view. Right, in 2008, we announced that you can now have 256 concurrent threads executing. That's up from 64 before. Right. And the hardware vendors were, yes, cash. Right. It's like they were rolling in the superdomes and trying to sell you big iron. What is the intrinsic problem here? If you have all these threads of execution, you're synchronizing states between them. So at first we had 64 guys synchronizing on a lock on the memory bus, for example, or to get access to a memory block. Now we have 256. So at one point in time, how many of you are watching your kernel level activity inside your server? For those of you who are visually oriented, that's the red line in Task Manager. All right? If you turn it on, yes, thank you. What that says is like, if we're synchronizing, right, it shows up as a lot of kernel activity most of the time. So then we're spending more time internal bookkeeping, finding about resources, waiting on each other, than actually doing work for you. Which is why we invented the cooperative scheduler in 7.0 to actually be able to have a more efficient way of dealing with your workloads inside SQL Server But still, it's like there is a maximum number of concurrent threads that we can deal with. Right. The other part is it's like we're dealing with NUMA architectures. Right. That means is that memory is local to the CPU. Right. We have most of the times, most common machines we buy today, they have four physical sockets and then a bunch of logical procs on those. So that means is that only 1/4 of your memory is really local. And then the other 75% of your memory, you actually have to hop over the bus. Now, in most architectures these days, that's a single hop. Now, if you go beyond four sockets, you will find that your cost of getting to memory is going to be way more expensive. If we talk about the number of processors like here, right, most likely you don't have them all on one board. So you're starting to incur delays there. Now, the delay is not the problem. The problem is the mismatch. Here we have a thread that can do the same operation blazingly fast because everything is local. The other thread actually executes on the processor over there, and he has to wait. All right. So that's why a lot of people are reaching out to scale out. Why? Not because the bottom line is faster, but it's more equal. And it is a lot cheaper. Because I can buy a lot of those blades with just 6 disks in there, 4 procs, and keep stacking them. And yes, I need to write slightly more sophisticated code, but at the end of the day, most companies use IT as a value add to their business processes, not the other way around, right? IT itself is not the goal. So the bottom line actually counts, which is one of the big reasons why actually people like this. So now let's get back, and this slide was actually, I ripped this out of a deck that I presented to my management team at the time. I changed the wording slightly, but. So if you're operating a 7x24 service that needs to be online, right, I'm taking the example of like this is an internet-facing service, but it's like there are lots of companies that have these kind of services in-house, whereas like you simply, they're crucial. You're around the world, you're a global enterprise, and you need to be able to operate in your environment in a continuous 7x24 basis. So you must be online. Now the problem is, I need to change my schema. We talked about this. All right, state changes cause blockage. Bulk operations, right? How do you deal with large changes? Oh, well, now we need partition tables because then we can move out a window and slide them out because otherwise I cannot efficiently delete a whole set of rows. All things I need to start thinking about, right? It's easier said by a developer, oh, we have a logging table, until you have to purge it, right? And so a lot of people don't actually think about these kind of restrictions. Then the last thing is, it's like, how do we deal with service upgrade, but also service downgrade? How many of you experience the fact when you roll something out, it goes completely south? Right? We all have, just admit it. And if you don't, you will soon. Because it will fail at one point. We are not perfect. We overlook things. And then stuff starts to roll back. And the problem is, we hardly plan for it. What is in case, what are we going to do? And if you look at Amazon, they actually take a very rigorous approach. They run relational database systems for some of their workloads. And if they have updates, they actually maintain an N-1, an N, and an N+1 at the same time. And yes, that requires a lot of code and a lot of work and testing, and it's expensive. But they figured out that that's cheaper than dropping somebody's shopping cart. Because that's the end result if they would lose the order. Right? And probably that user will not come back. So we talked about all these things that are on there. Now another part that is like is near and dear to my heart, which is why I have allergic reactions to object relational mapping technologies. I'll come clean with you. But it's specifically because of this reason. What is the key difference? If you look at what a foreign key relationship is, right, and where the ownership of the relationship is, and where the value is residing, it is 180 degrees opposite to what the developer is actually using to implement this. Most developers implement this through a containment model, which puts the relationship ownership completely on the other side of the object. This is why object relational mapping technologies have to do so much mumbo jumbo under the covers to make up for this. Because the order in which you establish the relationship, therefore, is exactly opposite. And at creation time, that might not be that bad. But at deletion time, it's a lot more fun. And I've seen very interesting behaviors if people start to delete things through an object relational mapping technology. So it's something to keep in mind. Right? I'm not saying object relational mapping technologies have no use. They definitely get you started faster. You have to write a lot less code. But please be aware of this impedance mismatch. Right, if you go in with your eyes open, that's all I'm asking for. So then the last point is like the need of schema. Right, as I said, it's like in the relational world, it's like we have to go with schema first. What does the NoSQL guy do? If he is a document store, the document is the schema. So what is the end result? He has a schema per instance. Think about that for a moment. What does that mean with regards to schema change? It's the task of the application. What is the beauty of that? You amortize the cost of schema upgrade over time because you only need to upgrade it either when you forcefully run through all your document instances or because you're just waiting for the application to swap it in, detect, hey, this was an old one, I'll do it on the fly, do it once, and at that point you're done. Which is actually one of the strategies we used. So we completely amortize the cost of schema change over time, but it's now the app's problem. Now, so we're trading things. Right? We're making things and moving them around inside the system. And so one of the questions you should ask yourselves, like, who actually owns the schema? Now, one of the key advantages, of course, of having a shared schema at the server level is that we have a large set of tools that we can use against it. Right? We pointed at the schema, and now we have a report writer that I can just drag some columns in and it's like, be done. How does that work? If I have my app controlling the schema. Now I need to start writing apps that are much more dynamic and resilient to the different change schemas. All right. Which is a good thing and a bad thing. But again, it's something that you need to go in with your eyes open. So the last thing is about the variety, the velocity, and the volume of data. All right. This is the last thing that actually drives the NoSQL guys to find other ways. Right. And this actually comes from the change of where is like the scale of data is changing so much that we need to change our ways of how we get the insight from the data. So what do we do today? So today, this is a typical workflow. We have a bunch of databases, we have some data coming in. It's like financial data. Sorry for the callers, doesn't really work out. So we stick it in our data warehouse. And then we have some event information. I call it logs right now. And it's like we process the logs and we stuff information into our database based on the questions that we know that we need to ask. What do we do with the rest? We trash it. Right? Our ETL processes today are based on this model. Run something in, throw it away on the side. That goes on over there. It's like if you're in the right lane, you go into the database. If you're on the left lane, it's goodbye. What is the problem with this approach? If we need to answer a question that was not answered by the data we have, but was actually in the trash, we cannot go back and retrieve the trash. So, in the new world, what do? They simply say, like, hey, storage is cheap enough. That's why, again, low cost, high available storage. We'll just keep storing it. And if we have a question, we'll ask it, we'll extract it at that point in time, and add it back. There are also regulations now, of course, with the increasing amount of regulatory aspects that we need to keep more data. Where do we keep it? We don't have to keep that in the database. It just needs to be accessible. And it needs to be highly available because of regulations. So we talked about the data explosion yesterday, but I'll skip that. So what are the real problems that NoSQL, in my opinion, is trying to address? First of all, it starts with the developer. They really looked at it as like, hey, we have a problem as a programmer. We have a persistence problem. And we need a data fabric that can help us. Give us something that fixes the impedance mismatch between how the developer thinks and how the storage fabric works. They're trying to solve concurrent threading problems by simply using multiple processors and processes so they can actually span it out. All right. That's the second thing that they're actually trying to get their handle on. They're also, by doing that, achieving economy of scale. All right. And they're not trying to model the world because the world doesn't want to be modeled. All right, they just model what they need. Don't get me wrong. Even in an unstructured data stream, if you want to extract information out of it, there is schema. Because you need to know what you're going after. But it's probably a key value pair, column number 25 in a comma separated file, whatever. There is logic to it. There needs to be predictability and you need to be able to programmatically discover the data. So it's not that unstructured as we might believe it is. We do need to operate this in a 7x24 world. So again, it's like we need to assume failure. We need to assume that it's like we need to be able to maintain our environment. And we need to do this while taking in consideration the fact that we have a data explosion on the other side, only creating more work. All right. So if you now dissect that into patterns that they use, they have some interesting patterns, which we can all apply actually to our own world as well. They favor data locality. Right, so they bring Mohammed to the mountain, as I said yesterday, and not the other way around. They bring the processing power to the data. They do that through either function shipping or by starting processes on the local box. Right, so either through an MPI kind of model, or they simply ship the whole program over by using MapReduce, for example, is one of the examples. They actually, if you start looking under the covers, their biggest thing that they like to do is replicate. They replicate like bunnies. They take data and move it around for high availability, to improve data locality, to do interesting tricks like deferred indexing. Right? Trivia question. The update of an index in SQL Server, when is it being done? Sorry? Paid split. Now when? In this transaction scope of the operation, right? How many times do you really need that? But again, this comes back to rule number one. We have to be consistent at all times. Or true, sorry, yes, thank you. Forgot my own rules. Right? So one of the tricks that we actually played, we'll see that in a moment, is using deferred indexing. Application level schema management. Trying to push the ownership of the schema to another place. Have relationships in the data instead of across, and therefore breaking down the ownership of relationships. And then the last one is like, how do we interact with the data? Through what kind of patterns? And hopefully we do that in a chunky way, because otherwise you will die. So let's dive into my little example. This was my wonderful schema that I created for the directory, together with one of my colleagues, Kim Cameron. It actually worked. We proved it worked. We actually proved it performed better than Active Directory on a single node. We proved that it could hold all the information of the Microsoft Active Directory in a single node running on Windows or SQL Express. So we thought, next project, we're done. So we presented this schema to our colleagues, and they said, great, those are impressive numbers. How can we weave our information into this? Problem number one. So we thought about that, and we had an extensibility mechanism, which actually led to the fact that it's like people could write their own extension table that they owned, but that became another join. So now it's like our query execution framework at the app layer needed to be smarter. It's like derive the information and start to bring those things in. We also had a very simple version where it's like we actually used name value pairs. All great ideas. The problem was when we took this schema in production on a server that we were hosting in Azure, the first schema update that we took down the server for 7 hours. I'm not kidding you. Right? It's like, and the reason was, it's like we needed to unbind relationships, we needed to rewire things, it's like the application wasn't able to deal with the fact that it's like there was old schema, because it's like parts of it were written in Link to SQL, believe it or not. It's like, the server went down, and we actually had to go back. Which is why we learned the hard way that it's like if you don't plan for a rollback, you actually are going to fail. So, where do we go from here? So we looked at, it's like, what is the NoSQL guys are doing? And we said, it's like, hey, we can learn something from that. How is it that we can apply this? How can we take this and move it in? And we coined it Data Islands. It's like, that's not a name that's going to stick. Doesn't matter. The key thing is like, it's an isolated bag of related data. But it's structured. It has its own schema. And so what we were doing, we were dumbing down our data store. Because what is the thing that gets in the way if you start to have a sharded environment or a partitioned environment? You cannot have foreign keys between nodes. So first thing to get rid of are your foreign keys. Now it's like you need to deal with your relationship management differently. So we basically came up with this very simple approach where we had documents, we had properties, and we had relationships. Now, let's be very explicit here what's going on. The authoritative data only lives inside a document. We then use deferred processing to actually extract the site tables on the for properties and relationships. So there is only one authority. Something looks like this. This is just a example. It's like we actually, it's like when we implemented it, it became XML at some point, but that's fine. The thing is that we're using, which was the key relief on our system, right? Now we move to documents. We didn't have our versioning problem. We could amortize our schema changes over time. Our applications tier or app tiers were in charge of that. Our web front ends or our REST front ends were able to deal with that and project it out to the services that were consuming it. Everybody happy so far. Now what we needed to do is to make this all work is we had atomicity at the store level. So a document has a key, and there are some uniqueness constraints that we did enforce. But that was the degree of atomicity. All the other things were done through deferred processing, through a system which we call property promotion. And what we did there is like we pulled out, based on metadata that was configurable by the administrator, we pulled out information about which documents, it's like what properties do you want to be indexable? This actually had a very interesting side effect. If you don't want that a user can be found based on his physical ID or his like his social security number, you simply say now that it's like social security number is not a search argument that you populate. Right? The documents in the store were actually encrypted and digitally signed, so we knew that they weren't being tampered with. And we knew that it's like you needed a key to actually read the value. So we were truly pushing out and propagating properties out there. And the other thing is like, and this is just another kind of property, is like we had a relationship index. Now, the way that we all made this work by applying a pattern called CQRS, right, the command query responsibility segregation pattern. This is a very interesting pattern to use inside a data service. Because it allows you to do exactly that. You have a protocol endpoint, in our case this was an OData endpoint, where it's like we get the information in, so we got an expression tree that was actually handed off. We wrote a component that was the query manager. All right, the query manager then projected only over the index services. Because you could only answer the question based on index information. Otherwise, you weren't allowed to reach it. What do you get back from the index server? A list of document IDs, key value pairs. You now go to the document store, fetch them. If you want to have a projection, you need to hand it over to the view service. Otherwise, you can hand over the documents directly based on the if the application had the certificate that actually could decrypt them. Otherwise, we couldn't do this. So that was the architecture that we ended up with. Now, what that allowed us to do is actually bring down the number of nodes at the end to a lot more smaller nodes instead of a few big ones. Because we could scale and partition over a much more smaller shard key. All right, and we could keep things together. The other part is that the application uptime has been much higher. We've had an outage. We made more mistakes. All right. But it did prove that it's like those changes helped us. And this, yes, still runs on SQL Server. How do we create the property indexes and the relational graphs? They're just SQL tables. They're just derived data. But the beauty is, I now can make that index table local to the query processor node. Right? Because it's all deferred. And the only thing that I need is a queue to actually make sure that these things exist or get propagated, sorry. So what we did is we learned from the NoSQL guys, trying to figure out is like what the underlying patterns are. And we used that to our advantage. to build up a system that actually fitted our needs. So hopefully you learned something from this as well, and you found this interesting and you can apply it yourself. I'm happy to take any questions. Otherwise, thank you very much. In the reference, the resource slide, there actually are a bunch of resources, which the top one is like is from Eric Meyer, that's the guy who I used to work for, which actually describes the impedance mismatch between the object model and the foreign key model. If you are looking for just to get educated about NoSQL databases, the NoSQL databases white paper, an introduction by Christoph Strauss from the Stuttgart University, is a great independent voice. It's not very tainted by a lot of commercial activities. And then there is some other interesting things in there. What we also, is like we described some of the case studies that we use to build scalable systems this way in the gaming experience case study, where we use this in some other cases internally. So that's that. I'm done. Thank you.